This episode of Coffee House Shots is sponsored by Alliance Witten Investment Trust. From the OPEC oil crisis of the 1970s, the financial crash in 2008, to the COVID epidemic and Liz Truss's doomed premiership, there has been no shortage of economic crises over the last 58 years. And yet, throughout that time, every single year, without fail, we've paid out an increased dividend to our shareholders. In fact, Alliance Witten's history dates all the way back to 1888. And today, we manage around £5 billion in assets. If you're looking for a less stressful way to invest in stocks and shares, learn more about Alliance Witten and find your comfort zone.
Hello and welcome to this special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm James Hill and I'm delighted to be joined today by Lord Haseltine, Foreign Environment Secretary and Defence Secretary too. Lord Haseltine, thank you very much for coming today.
Great pleasure.
And you've obviously got now a second book of your memoirs out. I think something like 24 years after the first one, Life in the Jungle. Tell us why this book and why now?
Well, this is not the book I ever intended to write. I thought I'd done a biography, and I would not be back in public life after 1997. And then, of course, what happened was that David Cameron invited me, to write a suggestion for the manifesto. He invited me to go to Liverpool with him, and step by step, I was back in the corridors of power. So really, the book had two purposes. One was to update my political experience, and secondly, to satisfy my own curiosity as to whether any of the things I'd done in government actually had any real lasting effect.
And your conclusion of that was?
I think that I can claim to have played a role in the devolution of power from London to the great cities. I think I can claim a role to have shown how you regenerate deprived urban areas. And my surprise, frankly, is that having now got such precedence, this government isn't doing it. The subtitle of the book is about regeneration of our national economy. And the way to do it, to me, is obvious. It is to devolve more power to mayors and to make money available based on local plans as opposed to the functional monopoly of the spending departments in London.
I mean, before we come on to your career, I mean, that would be a fantastic second question would be, what do you think this government is doing very well at and what is it doing not so well at?
Well, I think you have to personalise it. I think that Keir Starmer is actually doing the right things in the face of the terrible dilemma that the election of President Trump has confronted not just this country, but the world. But I'm afraid that I'm not impressed by the Chancellor. As I say, I think that there are so many obvious things that she should be doing and quite a few obvious things she shouldn't be doing. One of them, I have created a small business. Well, it's now not that small. But the inheritance tax is a major threat to the vital sector of the economy, the family business, and to make it clear that huge bills have got to be paid on the death of the present shareholder really means either that the family businesses sell up, float, or they spend their life hoarding cash in order that they've got something to pay the inheritance tax with. All of that, I think, is bad for the British economy and bad for society at large, because those family businesses are actually the stable feature of the private sector across the towns and cities of our country.
You've always argued for a regional policy. Do you think this government is following the so-called Treasury mindset far too much?
I don't believe in a regional policy. I believe in a policy based on the local economies, and that's not the same.
Fair point.
It's one thing to say in Merseyside, you come from Liverpool, Manchester, you come from Manchester. People understand that and feel loyalties and identify. If you say you come from the Northwest, I don't think it has anything like the same. And in the counties, they all know about the county regiments and about the county cricket club and all that. So those local loyalties mean something. And there are huge numbers of very talented, energetic people, both in the public and private sector there. You've got all the universities and you've got the private sector businesses and you've got a lot of public sector activities. They should all be asked to play a role in building those local economies, and they should be provided with access to the money. I mean, this government, it's actually strapped for cash. That's quite obvious. But within the existing public expenditure profiles, there's about £10 billion a year, which at the moment will be hypothecated to transport or to housing or to skills or education. And that money is designed to be spent as the civil servants in those local, those national governments determine. What it should be used for is to say to the people, we'll say of Manchester or Birmingham or Oxfordshire or whatever, look, this money is available. You help us design a strategy based on what you know to be necessary to really get your local economies moving. And that they should be doing, and they're not.
I take your point about local rather than regional. Forgive me, that's my fault. But do you think the Treasury has too much kind of say over all of this, and that their Labour government perhaps coming in with a lack of vision about what it wanted to do was too willing to go along with what the Treasury mandarins were perhaps saying?
Well, you know, I've never been a Treasury minister, and I've been on the other side of the coin. But I do respect the fact that the Treasury know perfectly well that there are hungry mouths all over the country. So they've got to keep a grip on it. The fact of the matter is, we all know now that we are spending money on welfare of one sort or another in an ageing population, which is not sustainable. And that's a very, very uncomfortable position to be. But the fact of the matter is that the Treasury do not believe in a devolved strategy. They don't believe in involving local communities. And the only Chancellor that I know who did believe it and do it was George Osborne.
Reading the book, and it seems to return to many of the themes that come up throughout your career, particularly Europe, and talking much more about the importance of localism, as you say. What do you think from your sort of 50 years in politics, and you first stood in 1959, you're a special advisor effectively in the 2010s, what do you think have you changed your mind about? And perhaps what do you think has proven true time and time again?
Well, undoubtedly, what changed me were the riots in Liverpool in 1981. I came into public life from a conventional middle-class background, and I climbed the ladder open to me, which was the Conservative ladder. Nothing has ever persuaded me that was the wrong decision. But when they rioted in Liverpool, I had an uncomfortable feeling this was not just about law and order. I said to Margaret at the time, look, to this Conservative government, law and order is absolutely paramount. But would you understand if I just went and walked the streets, talked to people, listened to what they said? And I did, with her agreement. The most interventionist thing any government ever did. The first day was fantastic. Well done. We're so pleased to see you. It may have taken a riot, but at least you're here and listening. Very rapidly, it occurred to me the problem. They all knew what was wrong. He was wrong, she was wrong, they were wrong. Everyone was wrong, except me. And there was no one in charge. And so I then made the extraordinary decision, well, I better try and find out what could work here. And I start preparing a list. I used to literally drive around and say, why is that empty, derelict land in the middle of this city? And someone would explain the problems. I said, okay, now we could try this with it. I had a large budget from the Secretary of State. And after 3 weeks, I produced this list saying these things could all be done. And then, of course, I realised that there was no one in charge, no one to do it. So for the next 18 months, every week I went and did it. But the Cabinet Secretary, Robert Armstrong, said, Michael, you were a man transformed by that experience. And I was, because, as I said, from my background, I had never come across the acute stress at the other end of the social structure. And it changed me. And of course, I also came to understand the extraordinary creative talent that is to be found in these places. David Cameron asked me to do a report. Well, I did a report for Margaret called It Took a Riot. David Cameron asked me to revisit that with Terry Leahy, a distinguished entrepreneur. And Terry and I, this would have been about 2010, I guess. Terry and I went to Liverpool. He was a Liverpudlian. And we listened. And the difference between It Took a Riot and the report we did,
No Stone Unturned,
was absolutely stark. Everybody wanted to help. They all knew what they wanted to do. They just wanted the chance.
And of course, we had riots last summer, you know, in Southport. Do you regret the fact that there doesn't seem to have been that kind of government willingness to go up there perhaps and listen to the extent that you did, what, 40 years ago?
Well, I think that the involvement, the personal involvement, is very important in politics. Everybody knows that. My own feeling is that if I was in charge of the devolution agenda, I would not only have a massive devolvement of power and elected mayors everywhere and the resources shared between central and local government, but I would also have a cabinet committee in charge, and each member of that committee, whether he came from housing or skills or education, would actually have a direct responsibility to work with one of the major local areas so that they weren't just thinking all the time about whatever their specialist title was, but about the totality of the community.
One of the things that really, I think, struck many Conservative admirers of you was not just your talents in government, but also your work in opposition. In the 1960s and the 1970s, you were able to totally take the fight to Labour government. How do you think that Kemi Badenoch and more broadly the Shadow Cabinet are currently doing at that role?
Well, I think that they are quite understandably bypassed by the crisis in the Ukraine. It's usually said that foreign affairs never determines the outcome of elections, and I think that is probably true. But at the moment, foreign affairs is the agenda item. And I think, quite rightly, the Conservatives are broadly supportive of the sort of things that the government are doing, and that is absolutely right in the circumstance. So you don't see them performing as an opposition. But that, frankly, it doesn't matter yet. This government is there for 4-5 years, and the essence of opposition is to watch what's happening and attack. You are opposition. You're not a substitute government at that stage. That will happen, and I see plenty of examples of where they will have ground upon which to find fertile soil.
You obviously were a minister in the 1980s. You came later back into government in the 2010s. There is a criticism in contemporary British politics that actually ministers don't have as much control as they should do. They feel unable, perhaps constrained by international obligations. Currently, there's a debate about the European Court of Human Rights. I wonder what your thoughts are on that. Do you think that ministers do have power and it's only weak ministers and weak governments that complain about that? Or do you think there has been a sense of power shifting away from Westminster and that needs to be corrected?
I am deeply depressed at the attempt to vilify the British civil service. In my experience, the civil service is a Rolls Royce. But Rolls Royces don't go anywhere without a driver and fuel, and that's what ministers have got to provide. And if you look at the shortage of time ministers spend, how do you expect the civil service to know what they're expected to do if come here today, gone tomorrow? I think also it has to be said that an awful lot of ministers don't have any views. They've got a party manifesto, they've got a few, slogans, but actually about running something, being in charge, meeting after meetings, making sure there's a summary and a timescale for implementation That's just not a culture that is generally around. So I really say, from my experience, I always got what I wanted from the civil servants. I may have made the wrong judgments, but they always delivered what I asked them to do. I'm afraid I have a very simple philosophy in life. Show me the problem, show me the person in charge. And it is not the civil servants. It is the ministers who are in charge.
And reading the book, I mean, the chapter that jumps out and has obviously got some headlines from those who remember is Westland. And, you know, 1986, which is probably the moment of maximum political danger for Margaret Thatcher between the Falklands and perhaps Nigel Lawson's resignation. I mean, you've looked at all the evidence. You talk about Charles Moore's book. You talk about John Knott's book. Have you been vindicated by subsequent accounts of that episode?
I'm afraid the book proves beyond peradventure that everything I said at the time was true. I didn't have as much evidence at the time, but I always believed the evidence would emerge. And little by little, it did. The most extraordinary example of it was, of course, John Knott, who was the previous defence secretary to me, but then chairman of the bank that acted for the Americans. And he produced a book in which he included words to the effect, Michael never knew who the party was operating in this takeover. It was Jimmy Goldsmith. Before the book had actually been published, it had been distributed to the press, but not published, he got a letter saying, if you publish this book, I will sue you, from James Hansen, who was another one involved in of Margaret's friends. So the book was hastily withdrawn, the page was torn out, but George Jones in the Daily Telegraph had actually outlined what was on the offending page. Anyway, it's all there quite clearly that a group of Margaret's friends acted in concert to help the Americans to win against the group that I believed in, which was a British-led European consortia. There is no doubt that it was an illegal act. It's easy to try and say this is anti-American, not at all. The Americans were quite clear. They saw Westland, a weak company with financial problems, as a possible vehicle for the production of their Black Hawk helicopter, acquisitioned by the British Ministry of Defence. The Ministry of Defence didn't want it. They briefed me so, I made it clear they didn't want it. But the Americans thought they bought the helicopter, the Westland, they'd be able to persuade the government to buy Black Hawks. My successor in the ministry, George Young, said the same thing. And I think 2 years later, the Americans sold Westland back to the Europeans. Perhaps if you want evidence of Margaret's complicity, John Wakeham was a whip at the time, the chief whip at the time. And he came to talk to me because there was going to be a debate in the House of Commons. And they wanted to know what I was going to say. And so I said to John, look, if Margaret will accept a degree of personal responsibility for what went wrong, I will be very modest in what I say. And I dictated the words Margaret had to use. Imagine John Wakeham going back to Margaret and saying, look, Prime Minister, Michael will be gentle in the House if you use these words. Well, anyone who knew Margaret would have known that that would have been lighting the blue touch paper. Anyway, the debate came. She used exactly the words that I had dictated. And if anything persuaded me, that she knew exactly what had been going on. And of course, Charles Moore in his book says, Charles, the authorised biography, said actually that if people had known at the time what they now know, it's difficult to see how she could have survived. And I think she couldn't have survived.
We are now in the centenary since Margaret Thatcher's birth this year. We're obviously 50 years since she was elected Conservative Party leader. I suppose, how do you feel sometimes? Because, you know, someone born in the 1990s and as someone who, you know, there's a lot of mythology that's grown up around Margaret Thatcher. I mean, Do you sort of resent that in a way? Because you obviously saw her as a politician in a cabinet. Do you think there's a lot of myths that have gone about her and actually people forget that she was mortal and sometimes people around her, certainly if not her, could be fairly political and capricious about how they made decisions?
People have to understand that working closely with someone, you don't have to be friends.
Yeah.
You have to be colleagues. You have certain loyalty and all that. I never really liked Margaret, and certainly was never a friend. But that completely misunderstands the necessary relationship. My relationship with Margaret was actually extremely good. Otherwise, why did she keep putting me into these important jobs? And she actually told Michael Jopling, the chief whip at the time, in 1982, she thought that I was her natural successor. You see, I privatised more, I think, of the public sector than any other minister. I ran my department down faster than any other of my colleagues. So Margaret and I had very similar views about many things, but it doesn't stop there. As I said earlier, Liverpool was the most interventionist thing any minister ever did. Margaret could have stopped me at any day, but she never did. Margaret's single greatest achievement was the creation of the European single market. And the reason she did it was totally clear. She knew that the common agricultural policy had been negotiated to serve the interests of France and Germany. And she knew that the single market, which was a great extension of that, would do the same. And she said, well, I'm not having that. So she sent Arthur Cofield to the negotiating table. He did a very good job. And Margaret was one of the architects of the single European market. What she couldn't have perhaps anticipated is that if you harmonize hundreds of thousands of regulations to make, there's just one where you had 20, whatever it was, individual countries before, you just had one. All those needed a detailed instruction. And so in the late 80s, when the economy wasn't doing that well, the small and medium companies were besieged by this deluge of regulations, which, you know, and these we're talking about, they work hard. And at night, they're trying to do their paperwork. And here was another thing about Brussels. And Margaret started to exploit that, and Euroscepticism was born.
There are three sort of episodes where potentially you could have become Conservative Party leader. I think 1990, potentially 1995, and the crisis of John Major. And then, you know, when John Major goes in 1997 after the disaster. I mean, do you ever look back on those three particular points and have any regrets about any of them?
Well, the only one I think that is real was 1990.
Yeah.
And I'd been on the back benches for 4 years. And I knew that there was a very considerable amount of support because people in the House of Commons kept coming up to me and my friends and saying, look, we're with him, we're yeah. with him. And I'm quite unashamed. We kept a list. We never asked anybody. We never solicited anyone. But those who came to us, we made a note. And so we knew pretty well how much support we had. But a criticism of me, and it's a legitimate one, I'm not really very clubbable. I don't really go along with the tea rooms, you know. I loved the job I did in government, and I went back to my ministry as quickly as I could. That was probably a mistake. I probably should have spent more time working the lads and lasses. But anyway, I didn't. So I didn't know a huge range of the sort of the blue chip type Tory, the one nation type Tory who might have voted for me and who actually voted for Douglas Hurd in the election. John knew these people extremely well. John
Whip.
And he had been in the Whip's office and he knew these people very well. So the phrase I use, he who wields the knife never wears the crown, I think was the killer for me. There were too many people who said he's divided the party, we must never have him as leader. I think they were wrong, but of course I would believe that. But on the other two occasions, John came to, this was 95, I think, John came to me, I was his deputy prime minister, and said, I'm thinking of putting myself up for leadership campaign because there's such feeling in the party. I'd like your view. What will you do? And I remember sitting there saying, well, John, when I'm your deputy prime minister, I've got no quarrels with you. We're doing our best, and you've never been anything other than helpful to me. So I said, I won't do it. The third occasion was 97, where, again, I'd had an angina attack in the election campaign. It didn't receive a lot of publicity, but I knew I'd had an angina attack. The key moment, I think, because there was great pressure on me, and John Major himself had made it clear he would support me, was when a good friend of mine, Michael Mates, rang me and said, Michael, I tell you, you've got a lot of support. It's going to go very well. And I said, I'm very sorry, but I won't do it. And the key conversation, beyond from talking to my wife about it, was my heart consultant, who I rang as part of the decision-making process. And I said, look, do you think that I'm physically fit to do the job of leader of the party? And he said, yes, I think you are. But can I talk to you as a friend? And he said, don't you think you've done enough for your party? Anyway, that was a decision. And do I resent it or regret it? No, it would have been a very bad decision for me. I'd have lasted a couple of years. The party, you've got to remember, Tony Blair was making Field Day, and it was, I think, off to a flying start. I was a pro-European, and the party was swinging anti-European. They'd had me out in 2 years, and I anticipated that and never gave them the chance.
And of course, you were the MP for Henley, and we know who succeeded you, Boris Johnson, and we know what went on with him. But I just wondered how you felt when you, as perhaps the most charismatic pro-European voice of your generation, was replaced by someone who'd made his name as a Eurosceptic Daily Telegraph journalist.
Well, I get on with Boris. He came and took over from me at Henley, and we had a very good relationship, very respectful. Talked about the Lion King and all that sort of thing. he's a man with no integrity. There is not a moral fibre that you can see in this guy. He will say anything, do anything, and I mean, he is responsible for the biggest act of self-harm of any nation I can remember. Brexit is a disaster. You see the cause and consequences of it all the time. And the quicker we restore Britain to the heart of Europe, the better it will be in our national self-interest and in the respect we're held throughout the world.
Just as a final question, Lord Heseltine, I just wondered, I mean, the reaction to this book, do you think there is that sense that contemporary politicians, future politicians, people in their 20s and 30s and 40s will be listening to sort of your clarion call for the policies that you've set out in this manifesto memoir?
Yes, I do believe that rather arrogantly, but because I know of the invitations I get and the audiences I address. So I believe there is a constituency to be addressed. But people, I address quite a large number of audiences of younger people. And it's a very common question. What would your advice be to me? And I always say, look, I've never met you. I don't know anything about you. So I cannot begin to give you advice as to what you should do and how you should do it. But I will give you one piece of advice. Do something that makes you look forward to a Monday morning. I think that's rather sound advice. I've always looked forward day by day to the next day's work. And that seems to me a happy note on which to conclude your interview.
Thank you. Well, we very much look forward to having you today on Coffee Hour Shots. So thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.